can we reliably comprehend that order from our perspective as those who live below the line, who don't have God's perspective, but a human perspective? Can we reliably always comprehend that order? Well, the book wisdom literature also tells us no. That's in many ways what the book of Job is about living under the line. Remember, Job doesn't have access to what's going on with divine counsel. He doesn't understand what God is up to. And that forms a big part of the struggles that he has with his suffering. Will you flourish if you align yourself with that reality, that objective order of creation? Yes. And Proverbs tells us that, right? Proverbs teaches us there is an objective order to creation, and we will flourish if we align ourselves with it. But then again, sometimes you won't. Sometimes you won't always flourish, at least flourish in the kind of typical understood sense of things being easy and going well for you, getting rich, and all your dreams come true. And that's really what Ecclesiastes wants to point out to us, the way in which life is mysterious, and it does not always true that those who do the right thing to experience all the things that they expect. Sometimes it's the people who appear to be making really unwise decisions and not living with the fundamental order of creation who seem to be doing well. And so there's a fundamental mystery to life under the line, so to speak. So the quote goes, education in a biblical sense means to read Proverbs and Ecclesiastes and Job and to be drawn to the debates that they provoke. Debates about who I am and what it means for my life to be a response to God's revelation. So that's just something to think about as we're studying the book of Job. If the only book of wisdom literature we had was the book of Proverbs, we would be in trouble. We need the complication that Job and Ecclesiastes both provide for us as we think about what it means to be wise, what it means to understand our life in this world. So just something to ponder and think about as we begin this morning. All right, so I want to review a little bit in terms of what we looked at in Job chapter 2. We read the entirety of Job chapter 2 last week, but we didn't end up getting to cover all of it because we began talking about different things. So just to kind of bring us up to speed before we get into Job 3 this morning, and we're trying to move quickly because we are trying to cover the whole book of Job in about 14 weeks, so I'm conscious of that objective. So Job 2, 1-13, essentially what happens in Job 2 is Satan goes back into the council with God, and God says to him, look, have you considered my servant Job? He's blameless, he's upright, he's suffering, but he hasn't cursed me like you said he would. And Satan says, well, it's easy for you to say, right? I mean, he's lost his wealth, and he's lost his children, he's lost, all these different things. But he's still got his health. So take away his health, and I am confident that he will curse you for your face. And the Lord says, well, he is in your hand. And then immediately Satan goes out and strikes Job with boils from head to toe, all over his body. Interestingly, if you look at the covenant curses in Deuteronomy, one of those covenant curses is that if you don't follow the law of God, and the people do this over time, one of the curses that they will receive is they will have boils on their body from head to toe. It's exactly the same language, from the crown of your head to the soles of your feet. Boils will come upon them. So really interesting, remember, boils came upon the Egyptians in that way during one of the plagues as God set his people free from slavery. So really interestingly, Job is not only experiencing this terrible pain in his body, of boils covering him, but he also is, in a sense, experiencing a covenant curse. This curse is meant to be for those who are lawbreakers, not lawkeepers. And yet Job experiences these things in his body. Job tells us that he went out to the ash heap. Perhaps this was a place where debris and trash was consumed outside of the settlement or the city. And he went and sat in the ashes and scraped himself with a broken piece of pottery. So Job is just in a desolate state at this point. And then his wife comes to him. This is an interesting exchange that takes place. Job 2:9-10, then his wife said to him, "Do you still hold fast to your integrity? Curse God and die." It's interesting, right? The wife here, this is the only appearance she has in the book, the only time she's mentioned. And the thing that she's doing, of course, is inviting Job to do what Satan is tempting him to look at his suffering and his experience and to relinquish his integrity and to curse God and give up, essentially. And Job's response to her is helpful. He says to her, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak." And notice that he doesn't castigate her. He doesn't condemn her. He just simply says, "You speak as one of the foolish women would speak." You're speaking foolishly, is what Job is saying. He doesn't call her a fool. And I think that's an interesting distinction. Shall we receive good from God, and shall we not receive evil? He asks rhetorically. Obviously, he means the answer to be, yes, we shall receive both. If we're going to receive good from God, we also must be willing to receive evil. Remember, the word evil there is better translated, I think, as calamity, disaster. It's not necessarily evil in the a satanic sense, or something that is malicious inherently. In all this, Job, the narrator says, did not sin with his lips. So again, we see Job echoing language that he used earlier when he said, after the death of his children and the loss of his herds, his wealth, "Naked I came to the womb, or came from the womb, naked I shall return to the dust. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord." So in both those circumstances, Job is affirming God's sovereignty, his rule over all things that take place, and he is submissive to it. And that submissiveness is really on display here. Now, what we're going to read in Job 3 is going to complicate our understanding of what it means for Job to submissively accept God's will, because he is going to say a lot of difficult things in Job 3, as we'll see in a moment, about the will of God. Then Job's three friends show up in verses 11 to 13. And we're going to have to think, as we go through the book of Job, as we're going to have to consider how we evaluate these men and their presence with Job. The narrator says that they have come to comfort Job, and yet we're going to find that they are not very good at that. And if their intention is to comfort Job, they go about in some very strange ways. Job 3 is going to give this long, extended speech about his suffering, his questions, the ways that he's wrestling with God. Immediately, Eliphaz is going to begin, one of his quote-unquote friends, is going to begin to critique Job's statement to God and criticize him when he's in the midst of the suffering. And that sets the tone for how these three quote-unquote friends are interacting with him. They are going to be critical. They're going to be judgmental. They're going to tell Job how he ought to think about his suffering. And really, I think they're using this moment to attack Job and this point of weakness and exposure in his suffering. And so I wonder, if they're trying to comfort him, they're not very good at it. So maybe best case scenario, they're just really terrible comforters. Worst case scenario, they see Job in this exposed position. Remember, Job was at the time the greatest man in the East. And if you are someone with authority and responsibility, what is almost always the case about how people there are always people who are going to be wanting to be what you have, right? They're going to want to be the greatest man in the East. They're going to want to take your position. And I wonder if that's not part of the dynamic here with Job's friends, who are seem to use this opportunity to almost gang up on him and speak to him things that that are certainly harmful. So we don't exactly know the motivation of the friends, but it is an interesting question to consider. Did you have a comment here?
I was going to, just about the fact that it sets it up at the beginning to where you have an accuser before God against
right.
Basically God's people, And then the rest of the book is about how these people are accusing, his friends are accusing him.
Yeah.
I mean, they're clearly being put in the position of the accuser, they're just people who are, the juxtaposition makes them culpable just from the fact that they're accusing, almost beyond anything else. Just the fact that they're accusing him puts them in a very questionable state, like right at the beginning of the book.
And they're doing that under the guise of spiritual piety and, you know, concern and care, which almost works, right? It'd be a lot better if they came and just said, you know, that we really hate you. This is a great time for us to tell you some things that are going to make you mad. But no, they come under the guise of being friends, and then their words, though, do seem to be really destructive. So we'll look more at that in future weeks, but just something to think about. They do show deference to Job in his suffering, and that's a good thing. They come and they sit with him in the dust. They throw dust up in the air in their own heads, and then they sit for 7 days and don't say anything. And then after 7 days, Job opens his mouth, and this is what he says. I'm going to spend a few minutes reading Job 3. This is a really fascinating text, and so if you've got it, you know, a copy of the Bible with you or on your device, I'd encourage you to take it. Job chapter 3. After this, so after those 7 days, Job's been sitting in the ash heap, scraping his body in silence with a broken piece of pottery. He's in immense pain. He's lost his children. His wife is apparently turned against him. He's lost his wealth, his status, all of these things, all. And with no explanation, right? There's been no word from the Lord. It's silence as far as he's concerned. And so in Job chapter 3, after this, Job opened his mouth and cursed the day of his birth. He doesn't curse God on striking. He curses the day of his birth, we're told by the narrator. And Job said, and this is one of the great poems of suffering, misery, that's ever been written, I would submit. And Job said this, "Let the day perish on which I was born, and the night that said a man is conceived. Let that day be darkness. May God above not seek it, nor light shine upon it. Let gloom and deep darkness claim it. Let clouds dwell upon it. Let the blackness of the day terrify it. That night, let thick darkness seize it. Let it not rejoice among the days of the year. Let it not come into the number of the months. Behold, let that night be barren. Let no joyful cry enter it. Let those curse it who curse the day, who are ready to rouse up Leviathan. Let the stars of its dawn be dark. Let it hope for light, but have none, nor see the eyelids of the morning. Because it did not shut the doors of my mother's womb, nor hide trouble from my eyes. Why did I not die at birth, come out from the womb and expire? Why did the knees receive me? Or why the breasts that I should nurse? For then I would have lain down and been quiet. I would have slept. Then I would have been at rest with kings and counselors of the earth who rebuilt ruins for themselves, or with princes who had gold, who filled their houses with silver. Or why was I not as a hidden stillborn child, as infants who never see the light? There the wicked cease from troubling, and there the weary are at rest. There the prisoners are at ease together. They hear not the voice of the taskmaster. The small and the great are there, and the slave is free from his master. Why is life given to him who is in misery, and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death but it comes not, and dig for it more than for hidden treasures? who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave. Why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? For my sighing comes instead of my bread, and my groanings are poured out like water. For the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. I am not at ease, nor am I quiet. I have no rest, but trouble comes. This is the word of the Lord. Thanks be to God, indeed. So a few things that I just want to point out about this lament that Job gives. And there really are some resonances here with Psalm 88. We sang Psalm 88 this fall, meditated on it a little bit. But that sense of darkness and overwhelmingness of the crushing weight of life in this world is present in both of those texts. This text breaks down, I think, into three parts pretty easily. Verses 3 to 10 form the way in which Job curses the day of his birth, as it says in the prelude there in verse 1. It's also interesting, you know, sometimes there's debates, right, about what's the shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept famously in John 11, but there's a great candidate here. You've got a kid that's trying to memorize the Bible verse. And Job said, is Job 3, verse 2. That's the entirety of the verse. So, you know, there's another easily memorable scripture verse.
It's going to be my life verse now.
There you go. Sorry. So Job 3, 3 through 10 is really the first part of this chapter. Here Job indeed is cursing the day of his birth, but not just the day of his birth, but also the night of his conception, right? He's saying, I wish that this day, this night would be barren, there would be no joy, let it be dark, let darkness claim it. Essentially, he's almost saying, I wish I had never been born, right? I wish I had never been conceived, even, is what he's saying. Then, in verses 11 through 19, Job is speaking about death. He is saying, why was I born? Why couldn't I have died in birth, right, as I was being born? Then I would have been spared all of this suffering. And then he goes even further than that and says, why couldn't I have died in the womb, in verse 16? Why was I not hidden as a hidden stillborn child, as an infant who never sees the light? He says, essentially, why couldn't I have died before birth, either at birth or before birth? And notice that what he says, the promise of death, from his perspective, and this is, there's truth in this. He would have lain down and have been quiet. He would have slept and have been at rest. He would have been given rest in his weariness if he had been given the gift of death. And that's an interesting thing to think about, consider Job's words here. And then finally, in 20 to 26, we have Job's questions and his unrest. First, an initial question in verses 20 to 22. Why is life given to him who is in misery and life to the bitter in soul, who long for death, but it comes not, who dig for it, that is, who dig for death, more than for hidden treasures, who rejoice exceedingly and are glad when they find the grave? I mean, clearly what he's wrestling with here is, why has God done all of these things and taken all these things from me and given me this horrible physical affliction and he hasn't taken my life? Like, why not end this? You know, why not end this suffering? Job can't see a way out of the pit, so he is questioning why the Lord has not also taken his life, which of course is the one thing that the Lord has not taken, right? He told Satan, you know, everything, but he can't take his life. Then in verse 23, I think this is really the key question. of the whole chapter here. Job says, why is light given to a man whose way is hidden, whom God has hedged in? This is the circumstance in which Job finds himself. Why is God continuing to give him light and life when his way is hidden, when he is confused, and God actually has hedged him in? God has backed him into a corner where he cannot escape. And then 24 to 26 concludes that with a kind of lament that he is not at ease, that he is not at quiet, he has no rest, but trouble continues to come. Indeed, he says in verse 25, for the thing that I fear comes upon me, and what I dread befalls me. That's deeply ominous, and it's not only speaking, I don't think, about the loss that he has suffered in terms of physical things. He's also speaking about his increasing sense of God's distance and absence and silence. This is the thing, perhaps, that he fears more than anything else that he dreads, and this is what he knows now has come upon him. The back page, a few things here to say. First, who is the audience for Job's words? Certainly his three friends seem to be there. They respond to it. Clearly they hear it. But the Lord, ultimately, of course, is the audience. And Job's words there are a kind of prayer, in a sense, that he speaks to God. The significance of Job's speech here in this chapter is a key sort of turning point in the book. Right? In chapters 1 and 2, when Job says, naked I came from the womb, naked I shall return. The Lord giveth, the Lord taketh away, blessed be the name of the Lord. Who could critique that? Right? Who could critique what Job says in response to his wife? Shall we receive good from the Lord's hand, if not also receive calamity or disaster? Who could critique that? Right? These are things that people quote often when they're trying to respond to suffering. But that's not quite true about Job 3, right? There are some things that people could critique here. And there might be some things you're critiquing as you hear it, read, or as you read it this morning. Certainly Job's friends see things to attack. And so this statement that Job makes here becomes one of the fundamental things that his friends, his quote-unquote friends, begin to attack him for, the ways that he thinks that he and speak to God. Now, the important thing to say is that at the end of Job's words are justified, right? The Lord comes and he says to his friends, you did not speak right with me as Job did. You didn't speak right about me, but Job spoke right about me. And he vindicates Job. So then, what do we make of this? What do we make of this speech? We'll talk about this for the time we have remaining. How is this speech a speech of faith? What does it mean here to see Job's words as, quote, an example of suffering and patience and steadfastness, as James puts it in James 5? So I just want to kick that out to you guys for some thought and discussion for a few moments. Yeah, Alexis?
Well, I think it's interesting the contrast, right? His wife earlier was saying, hey, just curse God and die. But instead of cursing God, he's instead cursing his own life. It's like God can do whatever he wants, but I don't like this situation.
Right.
And I just think that's an interesting contrast there, because if you think about it, his wife also lost children.
Yes.
Also lost, her husband is sitting here and boiling and festering. She's also suffered this.
Absolutely.
As well. And her reaction is not one of faith, but of your circumstances, but still trust God in it.
Yeah. No, that's absolutely right. What else? What do we think? How does Job function as a kind of prophet here, a kind of example of what it means to suffer righteously? How does that square with what we read? Yeah, Jeremy.
I think that it's possible that just at the beginning, that there are things which are, you would not necessarily commend. I actually think that it's fine to actually say that this is the closest that he comes in the entire book to actually accusing God of wrong. But he does not double down on those statements as the book continues. Instead, he enters into other discussions with friends, and then he makes these startling confessions later in the book. But at this beginning, I was like, I actually don't have a problem with this being the time he questions things most, and then ends up basically talking himself into a better position. Because, I mean, it certainly sounds like he could be accused of doing wrong here. I think that that's like, I don't know what the book is kind of setting up. It's like, you can't just take it by itself. If the book ended there, you could suggest that he actually was in the wrong, but only through, he doesn't stay there. So I actually think that it's fine if somebody thinks that he's actually in the wrong here, but he doesn't stay there.
Well, certainly I agree with the statement that the book, the rest of Job matters, but this is hardly the only, I mean, we're going to see that as we go through Job. This is certainly not the only place where he really, you know, says really hard things to the Lord.
That's right.
But it certainly is true that the rest of the book matters. And that certainly is a statement is right, but if this is not, as Christians, I don't think, a place where we're meant to stay, right? The speech that he made, that is that, you know, if you remain in that place for 10 years, right, it's probably a problem. You're just continually saying these things to the Lord over and over again. That probably is. But yeah, it certainly, I agree that this is not something that you want to. There are dangerous things about if you were to stay in this kind of place. But it is a place where Job goes. He doesn't stay there. He does move through different experiences of suffering. But it is a place he goes. What does Job do well here? What do we want to commend him for? If there's something to commend, what should be commended in his speech? Yeah, Bonnie.
He's honest.
Yeah.
He's honest about his greed. He's not trying to say, oh, well, other people have it worse than me. He's not trying to cover up his greed in some socially acceptable way. He's really lamenting, and I think it parallels a lot of the Psalms of lament as well.
Right.
That you have to go through the lament in order to see God's faithfulness afterwards.
Right. Yeah. No, that's exactly right. Yeah. It's honest, and I think that is something that we have to see here. And notice and feel. It's viscerally honest, right? It really is the kinds of things that people think when they're in the midst of suffering, right? People think, why was I born? You know? What was the point? Why did that happen? People really do think things like, I wish that I had died in the womb, or that I had died before birth, or at birth. Because I would have been, we talked about this several weeks ago, with miscarriage. I mean, that is one of the gifts that's given to our children who die in the womb, is that they don't suffer the things that we suffer in this world. They're not ever going to have the things that Job had and then lose them and have to wrestle with that. And God, you know, they go right to be with Jesus. And so, it's understandable, these things that people wrestle with, that you might have wrestled with. People really do say sometimes, I wish I could just die. Right? I mean, that's the thing that people can feel in the midst of suffering. And I hope that I'm not endorsing, of course, you know, suicide. Suicide is ethically and biblically wrong. You're not God. You don't get to decide when you live or die. Only the Lord determines that. It is a sin to put yourself in God's place in that way. But it is a way that we feel at times. And we do long for death at times. And I think that's okay. I mean, I remember meeting with Kirshner several days, you know, years ago, before she died. Her husband had died, and she had physical problems. You know, she was confident about what was next, and she just, every time we met, she was just asking, like, why have I not died yet? You know, what is the Lord doing? Like, I just want to go be with Him. And that's, you know, that's not a loss of faith. That's not, that's in some ways, it's a commendable thing for for those of us who are in Christ who run the race. Anyway, I do think that's right, Bonnie, that there's an honesty here that is commendable before the Lord. It shows that we cannot, there's no benefit in hiding what we really feel from the Lord. There really isn't. Now, again, this isn't, as Jeremy pointed out, where Job stays. He does progress and move into other places with the Lord, but sometimes we have to go into the darkness of the valley before we can move through to the light of what's next. What else is commendable in this passage? Yeah, Ron and then Terry.
He's got three friends. He knows he's going to have a discussion. So he's just putting all the topics on the table.
That's right. That's true. Yeah.
I mean,
it's a starting point.
That's to generate conversation,
right,
as opposed to.
It's an icebreaker.
That's right.
Yeah, that's right. No, I understand what you mean. I he is putting it on the table before God and before his counselors, before his friends, so that they can begin to wrestle with it. And that's, I mean, as a pastor, I appreciate when somebody comes to my office and they just put it on the table, there's no messing around. There's just what's going on.
Let's get down to the
topic. I'd rather do that than take 3 months to get it's really important. And that's what Job's doing here. He's putting it on the table with the Lord, and that's commendable. It's an act of faith, in a sense, to do that, to not try to hide what we're really feeling or experiencing from God or from our friends.
Friends, yeah.
Yeah,
Terry. I think Job's suffering is not theoretical anymore.
Yeah.
For his friends, it's theoretical.
That's a huge divide, isn't it, right?
Yeah.
And that's one of the really hard things about suffering. Certainly about physical suffering, right? I don't have any idea what pain feels like to you. You don't know what it feels like for me, right? There is a kind of mysteriousness of pain, even physical pain, right? That is a totally personal experience. We've all had experiences where we wanted to take somebody's pain for them. And it is. It's theoretical unless it's you. And that you're the person who's experiencing it. So, I appreciate that. And that does certainly form the ways in which the counselors engage with Job's suffering versus how he engaged. They're looking at it like it's a theological problem, right? It's an interesting thing, right? A good guy, bad stuff happens to him. What could it mean? And Job is like, no, I'm the guy, right? It's happening to me. So it's not this abstract thing, it's just personal. That's a good point. Mike and Eric.
Is verse 26 saying that he has always had trouble? That's the way I'm reading it.
Uh-huh.
That just is different from what I've thought of Job.
Yeah. Let's see. Verse 26. I don't read it that way.
I've got a different version. Mine says I was not in safety, neither had I rest, neither was I quiet, yet trouble came.
Maybe, I don't know. I don't know that I can't speak to the Hebrew in terms of what translation is doing a better job. ESV reads, I am not at ease, nor am I quiet, I have no rest, but trouble comes. It's more of a present tense thing. More clearly, the translation that you have is including past aspects, right, in terms of tense. I suspect that Job is just describing his present experience, but I think it's a good question. Yeah. Eric, what was your question or comment?
Is it? I'm trying to think about nowadays, if we have Christian friends and someone's suffering, is it? Yeah, I just wonder at some point, I would want to affirm truths that we learn from the New Testament of, nothing can separate you from the love of God, that through all that you're suffering, you do have a purpose. God has a wonderful plan for your life.
How do you say these things to a person who's in this place that you're asking?
Yeah, I mean, I just wonder, can we find ourselves in the, as Christian accusers in a certain sense?
Yeah, sure.
Like,
sure.
Do we have to tread carefully? Like, yeah, I just, or is it a little different now that Jesus has come and,
right,
you know, suffered? And,
right.
Yeah. I guess we'll be unpacking that. And
right.
This,
it raises, and we'll close here before we sing, but yeah, it raises an interesting question, right? How do we rightfully engage with those who are in the place where Job is in Job 3 or in Psalm 88 or wherever? And yeah, certainly the time we speak matters. We do live after the life and death of Jesus. He was the ultimate sufferer, righteous sufferer. I think this is a big part, I mean, in terms of my ministry, this is something that I do a lot, right, engage with people in suffering. And this really is one of the hardest parts of my job. You walk into people in the worst moments of their life, supposed to say something, right? And that's terrifying. I mean, nobody likes that. You like that, you're crazy. But it's where pastors are called to go, and it's where Christians are called to go, too, generally. I think we have to learn the art of both being with people, sympathizing with their weakness and their suffering and their questions, while also modeling a faith in Christ and gently but confidently pointing them to the things that are true. Because it is, suffering feels like it always is going to be this way. And it's not. And if we let people believe that, then we're family. You know? Like, we do need to say things like, there's death and there's resurrection. And anyway, so yeah, I mean, we can misapply things as Christians for sure. I also don't want to take away the kind of burden that we should feel to encourage one another and not let each other stay in the kind of place of despair and overwhelm. Certainly our culture, the way our culture functions right now, it wants us to not speak to the people. Like, you know what I mean? Like, just wants people to be where they are and say, that's fine. And I do think the gospel calls us, and more than that, as we engage with each other in the places of darkness. We're called to push one another too. So that's what I would say. But it's an art. It's an art that we have to learn over time. Alright, Father, thank you for this passage and for Job's words, for his wisdom as we continue to reflect on them. And grant us grace, Lord, in all of these things.